From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the Journal Sentinel's Patrick Marley talks about the latest controversy surrounding the state's troubled Lincoln Hills Correctional Facility.
Later, a refugee resettlement worker in Wisconsin shares her impressions of a documentary on the European refugee crisis.
The way they showed the interview process and the way they whittled the large group down to the precious few that ended up making it through is a very accurate portrayal of what I see on the job.
We'll learn why Title IX is still relevant 45 years after it sought to level playing fields for women.
And contributor and theater critic Dave Beagle has been pretty impressed by what's on stage in Milwaukee this fall.
You know, I'm telling you, and it's rare, I think, at the start of the season where every play I see seems to be a good play.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is being accused of shutting down an internal affairs unit, which had exposed abuses at Lincoln Hills. That's the youth prison in northern Wisconsin, where some guards allegedly mistreated inmates.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Patrick Marley has been covering the issue and has a new story about Walker's actions. Marley shared his findings with WUWM's Annalise Hensel.
The department used to have what was called the Office of Special Operations, which was essentially their internal affairs unit. They began investigating Lincoln Hills in 2014 and continued their work as a criminal investigation got underway. We've been reporting on Lincoln Hills for a year and a half or so. The vast majority of what we know and what the public knows comes from reports that have been released under the open records law that were generated by the Office of Special Operations. That unit was shut down in June. And now we know from some records that were recently released that the leaders of the unit felt that work was being taken away from them because they had done too good a job of exposing the problems at this prison.
And how does Governor Walker's administration respond to that claim?
They say that that is not true, that they found some efficiencies that would allow them to continue to do internal investigations, but to do it in the way that they did before the creation of this unit. It's a relatively new unit created in the last few years, and that by parceling out this work, they think that they can do these internal investigations better, and that there was not a concern that they had done too good a job in closing it down.
And could you bring us up to speed with the status of the various probes? The federal government got wind of the problems there, and the federal government was talking about looking into this issue as well.
Well, criminal investigators have been looking at the prison for almost 3 years now. That probe is now headed by the FBI. They took over about a year into the investigation. They are very tight-lipped. They won't give us a timeline as to when it will conclude, whether they think charges are likely to be issued. Earlier, the investigation was conducted by the Attorney General of Wisconsin, Brad Schimmel's Department of Justice, and we do know that at least in one case, the local sheriff's office investigated an incident that they believe should be charged, passed that information on to Schimmel's office. No word if they or the FBI are going to consider charges in that specific case. Also, the U.S. Department of Justice is doing a pattern and practice review of the facility to see if there were a history of civil rights violations there. We don't know the status of that investigation. In the meantime, there's this ACLU lawsuit that has resulted in a ruling this summer from a federal judge that very substantial changes needed to be made at Lincoln Hills to reduce the use of solitary confinement and pepper spray. That is probably the source of the most information that we're getting at the moment about what's happening there.
So have any significant changes been put into place at Lincoln Hills?
There have been a lot of changes at Lincoln Hills. The Walker administration would say that they made very substantial changes in the early portion of this coming to light by installing more cameras at the prison, equipping all of the staff with body cameras, and giving them much more extensive training than they'd had in the past. They used to get about 2 weeks of training. Now they're getting 6 or 7 weeks of training before they're on the job. That said, the ACLU lawsuit focuses on activities after all of those changes were made, and it was then that the federal judge determined that up until very recently, Lincoln Hills was likely to have violated the civil rights of these young inmates who are held there. And he has ordered very sweeping changes that include, you know, keeping kids out of solitary confinement except in very limited circumstances, using pepper spray only in, again, very limited circumstances, cannot use handcuffs or other restraints to the extent that they have. The judge has said that he wants a swift change, but that he understands that, you know, making changes at a prison where security is always a concern is a little bit like turning a large ship, and that you can't do some of these things overnight.
Do you predict that there will be any type of political fallout or other fallout to your story? I know that I've spoken to some political scientists who have said in the past that one of Governor Walker's potential weaknesses in his reelection bid is this unresolved issue at Lincoln Hills.
That's a good question. I mean, there have been a lot of stories about Lincoln Hills over the last year and a half. You know, I would not say that it has had a tremendous effect on his standing with the public. I don't know how, you know, people judge a governor on many issues. It is an issue that gets some people very frustrated and very upset about how the facility has been run. I don't know that we've seen, you know, a big weakening in the governor's numbers because of that issue. He says he's on top of it, and he has been working to resolve the problems there.
Patrick Marley covers state government for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He spoke with WUWM's Annalise Hensel, and you can find more coverage of the issues surrounding Lincoln Hills at WUWM.com.
We'll take a short break and then learn how a new documentary explores the European refugee crisis in novel ways. You're listening to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Europe and the U.S. are trying to figure out how to deal with what's been called a refugee crisis of epic proportions. People leaving by boat and by foot from North Africa and the Middle East into Europe, and some go to the United States. One film director wanted to explore the power dynamics between Europeans and the migrants that end up there and do it in an unconventional format.
Guido Hendrix's documentary, Stranger in Paradise, consists of a prologue, three acts, and an epilogue. It features an actor and real refugees discussing a European immigration system that, in practice, only allows resident status to a very select few.
Hendrix and Mary Flynn, the refugee program director for Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin, sat down with Lake Effect's Mayan Silver to offer some perspective on the film and the issues it raises.
When I was working on this film, at that time a lot of films were being made dealing with migration, and what I found very interesting that they had three typical characteristics. One of them, that they were all political correct, they were all somehow sentimental, and they all tried to reflect the suffering of the migrants, so to tell the story from their perspective, to get into their heads. And a lot of those films are important and interesting, but my aim was to actually radically break with all these three typical features we saw a lot in these films.
How did you aim to break with them?
Well, for example, the first act is everything but political correct. It's like the political incorrect sentiment or voice that's very prevalent. I mean, there are, for me as a filmmaker, I think there are two ways how to approach documentaries. One is to regard it as recording events, and the other one is as a subjective reflection of reality. And the latter is more related to documentary as an art form. So in that sense, I don't necessarily make the difference between documentary and fiction, but I see them more like genres. And I try to use those instruments to tell the story I want to tell. So that's why I came up with this actor who, in my opinion, was the best tool to convey this story. Like the whole idea of documentary that's more related to journalism, I don't believe in this, like this objectivity thing. I think if I want to see reality, I always say I just walk outside. In the cinema, I'm only interested in the vision or the subjective a reflection of reality of the filmmaker. So that's why, having said that, I allow myself to also play with these different forms and different structures, both documentary and fiction, and mix them.
So this actor was working with actual refugees, and I'm curious about how you got the refugees and how you worked them into the story. Actually, maybe you can answer that.
Yeah, our goal was from the very first start to really engage the migrants into this film, or the refugees. So basically, First, we also did a test shoot 1 year before, but at the real shooting, we spent about 2-3 days to meet them and to assemble the classes and to introduce ourselves and not only explain them that it was an actor that was standing in front of them and what this actor was going to say to them, but also try to explain the whole project and what our goal was, what we tried to convey. So, yeah, that was the way how we worked. So you could say we tried to make the film together and make them very aware of what was ahead of them.
So the actor was engaging with the refugees, and in Act One, you said it was the politically incorrect version of what's going around or what's considered to be said in Europe, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about one of the exchanges. He starts out with saying that how much the refugees cost and that each cost 26,000 euros for the first year that they're in Europe. And then he asks them to calculate how much that those people in the room cost. Can you tell me about the exchange that happened next when he says that? And I should also say that the entire room in the first act is just African immigrants. And he says that 55% of Africans who come to Europe will never work. And one of the refugees asks if it's an exaggeration. And then he proceeds to say this.
I don't think you are responsible. I blame the people in Europe, the so-called dreamers, the so-called idealists, the so-called left-wingers, who actually made this happen, who gave you false hope, who built you a Fata Morgana that is not real. But those people, they pretend it's gonna be easy. And that's why you all cross this terrible Mediterranean Sea. You take the risk, but especially for your children. How terrible is that? Your children can't decide if they wanna come or not. You just say, come with me. The little child goes with you, and then he drowns in the sea. That was his life. That was it for him.
So before
is that a better life? Is that fair? No, the world.
Is that fair?
No, it's not fair.
So why?
The world is not fair. I was born here, and you were born there. That's not fair.
Why
it's life.
Why they don't stay here and go to
we have to move on.
That's why I said we need your help because we have been paying tax.
I can't help you. Stop saying we need your help. You need to help each other. Help each other.
Can you tell me a little bit about that point in that exchange?
Yeah, it's also like actually our prime minister, he once said this, that it's like a geographical roulette. So if you are born there, it's unlucky, but we can do nothing about it. When I conducted my research and I was actually collecting all those, the arguments and the rhetorics that the more, you could say, nationalist conservatives use, there was just one part of it that they tend to blame more the left-wing politicians for making these myths and, you know, hiding the truth. So that was how that part ended up in the film, I think.
And he also talked about the fear Europeans have about the law of Allah coming over their land, and then the fear that immigrants will become, or migrants will become, the majority. So I was wondering, because this is typically, it's a white man who is representing Europe, and then it was African men who were, was that a conscious decision in that first act?
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily. If we could have found migrants from or refugees from the Middle East, they would have been in the classes like they are in the second and third act. But at the moment we were shooting, we were also a little bit dependent on what migrants were there at which point. So, yeah.
And was it a conscious decision to have the actor be a...
Yes. Yeah, that was, I mean, we needed a representation of Europe, and yeah, like I was also looking for an actor with a kind of gaze in his eyes that was hard, like a little bit mysterious, if that's the right word, so that you could not grasp who exactly is this guy, so he could also play these different roles in a convincing way, and yeah, so for me it was the most logical choice to make it a white person.
I mean, Europe is very different in its identity than it was. There's kind of all different types of Europeans. You can see, you know, Romanians in Spain and Turks in Germany and this and that everywhere. You know, so do you think that having a white male represent Europe is in and of itself somewhat problematic?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I mean, it's fair to argue this way. I mean, it's it's not necessarily wide, but I think to get this message more across, or also to I didn't necessarily want to make a caricature out of it, but I did want to emphasize this power, this balance, and so yeah.
Is it buying into an outdated narrative? You know what I'm saying?
I don't know. I mean, still, I think in Europe, I mean, the ones in power are mostly white, I would say, still. So, and it's just like the whole West, right? I mean, it's hard to argue the other way, I would think. Yeah, so, I mean, you could, of course, it's changing, and that's a good thing. But still, yeah, I think basically it's constructed like this.
Well, so I'm going to introduce Mary. Mary Flynn has been sitting here from the Lutheran Social Services Refugee Program. And I was just going to ask you about your take on the first act, because you've seen the film, right?
Yes.
And so you don't settle refugees in a vacuum. Have you come across some of these attitudes, and how do they come about?
I've absolutely seen those attitudes, and I find this film very powerful, and I'm really happy to be able to be sitting here with the filmmaker today, because it really is adding a lot of depth and context. In my job, part of our mission statement is we help people improve the quality of their lives. So I know that that's a very powerful statement. And when I saw your film, there was a lot of power in each of the acts. You know, Act One was the power of words and the power of misinformation. That, as you said, this you were portraying some of the comments that are being made about refugees, and they're not accurate. And that was a very powerful act, and I had a visceral response to it. And then Act Two, it really gets into, for me, the power of hope and the power of words once again, but in a way that lifts people up and gives them something to go for, you know, to work towards. And then in Act Three, the power of the system and the checks and balances that are in place for refugees and asylees. The way they showed the interview process and the way they whittled the large group down to the precious few that ended up making it through is a very accurate portrayal of what I see on the job. But the comments from Act One, the incorrectness, is something that I see quite a bit and that I hear quite a bit. So very powerful across the board.
Well, so, you know, would you say that you are trying to shape public opinion?
I think in my work, we're just trying to give the best information that we can and the most accurate that we know. There's always going to be differing opinions, differing thoughts about this whole situation. But shaping, no, I don't have the poetic license that a filmmaker might have to shape the message or the story. I just have the facts that I have to go on. And to be as honest as I can.
Well, so one of the things that the actor in the second act started talking about was he started talking about the colonial past of Europe. And then he also started talking about some facts refuting that presumably more liberal individuals would use to refute the idea that migrants are going to take over Europe. And then there's also the 7 case studies about removing borders.
So it's logic, right? Yeah. It's logic. If we open the world economy, according to Harvard University, one of the biggest, most important universities in the world, $35 trillion. Can you imagine? It's this classroom full of money, and that's times hundreds. That's $35 trillion that would be injected extra in the world economy. And it would only would work if you would come in. If you would help us out with jobs we don't want to do, so it's time Europe admits we need you.
Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, where you got those facts and what you were using with those?
Yeah, most of them were just, I read a lot of newspapers, but also scientific articles. So everything actually I could find to on the one hand, try to construct these two speeches. That's how actually I approach them, and that represent the dominant public discourse. And on the other hand, the third act was the most work and the most research. since these rules and regulations were very hard to get a hand on. So I need to speak with some people who used to work for Immigration Service, so I could get my hands on some classified papers, and then slowly we had to try to catch the essence of it, which was, in my opinion, like you said very well, somehow a knockout competition.
I need to ask you one last question. Is there anyone in here who left his fingerprints when he arrived here in Europe? Anyone?
Yeah.
Please stand up. Anyone else? Okay, please stand up. It's called the Dublin Regulation. It means when you ask for asylum, you always have to ask asylum in the first country that you entered. And because you left your fingerprints, everyone knows, no, they entered here. So for now, the people that are standing up, I would like you now to invite you to leave the room. You cannot get a permit of residence in the Netherlands. We'll never be able to. Thank you for coming. Thank you for coming. Good day.
And they had to, all these obstacles we tried to incorporate in the scene, and then you can see actually how basically the procedure works.
And Mary, coming from an American perspective and seeing our refugee system, do you see things similar or different to how the system was portrayed in the film?
It was a really interesting comparison between the way the United States is receiving refugees. It's so different, though. You know, the United States is surrounded by oceans and two very large other countries. So refugees arrive through a very organized governmental process. And when they do arrive, the United States gives them the tools that they need to do well and to become self-sufficient and independent. They arrive with full, permanent, documented status from day one. Not so in the film. And that's really what's going on right now in Europe is many people are just fleeing and are able to make it into Europe, but they don't have that process in place to give people work authorization, permanent housing. You know, we have adjustment of status or green card and a pathway to citizenship. That is not the case in Europe. So it was very interesting for me to see the film and compare those factors.
And what would you say above all was one of your messages from the film?
I think now we talked about the three acts, but there was also an epilogue in the film, and that was for me personally maybe the most important scene, because in that scene it's not about the power relations between European and migrants, but about the power relation between a filmmaker and the one he portrays in front of his camera. Because I found out, and I believe, that the difficult thing in documentary filmmaking, that it has an inherent exploitative character, and you have to be aware of that, you have to be transparent about it, and you have to deal with this. And that's what I was trying to tell in this last scene, and through this also to explain that we are all living in somehow parallel universes, like the migrants, Europe, but also as filmmakers going to our film festivals in these gated communities. And this is interesting. And I think the question, do we want to live these parallel universes, is an interesting question to ask.
Well, guys, thank you so much for talking about this film and coming in today. Thank you, Mary and Guido.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. It's a powerful film.
Mary Flynn directs the Refugee Resettlement Program for Lutheran Social Services of Wisconsin and Upper Michigan. Guido Hendricks is the director of the documentary Stranger in Paradise. They spoke with Mayon Silver. Stranger in Paradise shows one more time at the Milwaukee Film Festival this evening at the Oriental Theater.
Another break now, and then why Title IX is still important to discuss in America 45 years after it became law. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Like Effect Now on Milwaukee Public Radio, WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Title IX turned 45 this year. The federal law seeks to provide equal opportunities for women and girls in the academic setting. Its most visible work has been in intercollegiate sports, where colleges and universities were required to bring women's sports and sports scholarships in line with those offered to men.
But the organizers of an event later this month in Milwaukee say Title IX's mission and its impact go much further. Lisa Attenito is the executive director of the Women's Fund of Greater Milwaukee, and Donna Orender is the former commissioner of the WNBA, the Women's National Basketball Association. She'll give the keynote at the October 25th event. Attenito joins us in the studio. Orender on the phone. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure, a real pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh,
Lisa,
likewise.
It's good to be with you.
Thank you. You too, Donna.
So Title IX has been the law of the land for a long time. Things are different today than they were in the early 1970s. So let me ask you both this. After 45 years, why is it still vital to be talking about Title IX?
Okay, well, first of all, let me just say how grateful I am that things are different all these years later than they were in the 70s as it relates to so many issues. But in particular, the opportunities for young women to participate in sports, knowing how vital sports is as an engine to create opportunity and develop people's internal power, their outward connectivity, all of that. So I am really grateful. Why is it important today? Because we can't let it slip back. There is, there's all this talk today about doing something over again. It's almost like there's this reversion to, like, we should be how we once were. And I think we really have to focus on how we want to be in the future. And that is this commitment to developing all of our young people, male and females, with equal opportunity side by side.
At the same time, and I agree with everything that, Donna, you said, I think also we have to make note that it goes beyond inclusive sports for women and girls, but that Title IX opens the doors to pursue math, science, all the STEM careers, obviously. It also requires fair treatment for pregnant and parent students. It protects students from bullying and sexual harassment as well. So this is a law that really offers the opportunity and at the same time protection of people based on gender. So it's not only exclusive for girls. And I know there's always some talk around, you know, why is this girl-focused or women-focused? Well, Title IX doesn't only apply to the female person. It's really to create equity for all people in relationship to educational funding entities.
I want to rewind the metaphorical tape here. And Donna Orender, for people who don't know your story, what has Title IX meant to you on both a personal and professional level over the years?
Well, I guess starting backwards, I mean, it brought me to the leadership of the WNBA, a league of female professional basketball players that undoubtedly would never have existed if it wasn't for the opportunities created by Title IX. So professionally, it's had a huge impact. And personally as well, I played sports in a time when, I remember my teammates. We wrapped up little loaves of bread and tinfoil. That was our lunches. We didn't have any kind of the additional benefits that has since come along with sports or even what the boys had at the time. We played because we loved it passionately. And I still think that most athletes who play do so because they do passionately love it. But we didn't have any of those opportunities. Certainly, it wasn't an equitable level playing field.
Right. So you were the commissioner of the WNBA, and I think we're at the point where even if people aren't, you know, season ticket holders or regular viewers of the WNBA, they might take the existence of that league for granted. It is part of the sports landscape today. You played in the predecessor to that league. Can you talk about what professional women's sports looked like and felt like when you played versus where we are today?
It's funny. It's a great question. I think back, and it certainly didn't have the economic underpinnings that today's women's sports have, and believe me, they're still lacking today. Our crowds were not as big. We played in very small arenas around the country. But on the other hand, I think the way I view it as I reflect, we had the chance to play. And I think that's important. I think the opportunity to be able to showcase as elite athletes and communicating not only to young women and their families, but young men and their families, that women are capable and they're physically strong, and that what they do at a high and elite level is worthy of fandom. And so I think it was a good stake in the ground at that point in time to have that showcase. And I think it did create, you know, planted the seeds for the WNBA and the ABL to come not that long right after it.
Let me ask you both this. Where do you think women's sports and the opportunities that Title IX generates, where does it need to go, and what role today does Title IX play in that dynamic?
I mean, when I played sports, 1 in 27 girls played sports. I gave a TED talk about this, and I show this whole pyramid, and there's one little red pyramid representing a little girl amongst all these 27, right, representations of people. Now 1 in 2.5 girls play sports. So we can definitely see and feel in our schools, in our communities, in our colleges, that girls are out there on the playing fields, on the courts, they're out there competing. So we've made a lot of progress in participation. Are we there yet? No, we're not. We still have a ways to go in terms of our overall cultural acceptance and support of young women and grown women in the athletic endeavors.
Well, and Lisa, obviously you would have some hopes for the future of Title IX, or you would not feel, you know, compelled to do this event. So where are you coming from, and what would you hope people think about as they think about Title IX and where it needs to go from here?
Yeah, we at the Women's Fund, we looked at Title IX and this 45th anniversary sort of at two levels. One was to celebrate what it has done for women, not only providing the opportunity of sports, which we've spent a lot of time talking about, but we also can't avoid everything else Title IX has done, even access to college through sports scholarships and just the self-belief that I can accomplish it, that a young woman might carry into college is valuable. So I think at one hand, we want to celebrate what it has done, but we also want to showcase that it still has value today, that this law that is quote-unquote old is not outdated, but it still has value and can help advance equity for women and girls and all people, really, and in today's world.
I'd love to jump, because I think Lisa said something so important, and I think it also is reflective of the great work and thinking of the women in Milwaukee here, and certainly the goals here that we're trying to achieve the conversations are always female focused. We are, you know, guilty as charged. I do the same thing when it relates to Title IX. We don't talk enough about the positive impact that also has on young men at colleges, for example, at high schools, for example, in terms of their opportunities to express themselves in a wider variety of activities, and also for them to participate in a more equitable world, right? Where it's not just men on the field competing, or it's not just men in their science classes, but there are women there. And I think the ability to develop talent in a day and age when we have a race for global talent gives us a tremendous advantage by making sure that we are developing women and men side by side.
Right. I think if I know my story correctly, this all began for you when you were growing up and you wound up playing tennis on the boys' tennis team in high school. Today, a girl growing up and getting to high school probably doesn't have to do that. So is Title IX for girls who are coming of age today simply about opportunity or something broader than that?
I think it's much broader than that. I think opportunity is the gateway for accomplishment, achievement, for social change, for cultural development and growth. I think it's more than just getting a spot on the playing field, but I think that spot on the playing field, because I think the spot on the playing field is just so significant in unlocking so many other relational doors for creating a better community and society.
Yeah, I would add to that if we could approach sports and the world of sports from a non-gender, without a gender lens, imagine what the high school boys team would, basketball, football, whatever, coached by a woman, and what that would mean in their own development and impression of a woman, and how that could then apply to the world of work. So then would men participate in the workplace differently if they had had an experience of taking direction, guidance, influence from a woman at a younger age.
What, if any, are the concerns the two of you have about the future of Title IX and the current political climate?
Throughout the years, in the last 20 years, 15 years, 10 years, there's always talk about rolling back segments of Title IX. We've seen that recently, specifically as it relates to this sports piece. There is a three-pronged test for colleges, and there's always been talk about changing that. There is a weaponization in the gender wars of Title IX. So I'll give you a little story. My son's in high school, and he plays on the basketball team, and he comes home one day. I'm like, don't you have basketball practice? And he said, not today. The girls are in the gym. It's a Title IX thing. And I looked at him and said, who said that to you, right? It's like, it's a Title IX thing. It's not about the fact that the girls also have access to the gym. It's the fact that they have this right that takes it away from us. And I think that's still relevant. I still think a lot of the chatter and talk about what's happening at the collegiate level, where you see a decrease, let's say, in men's wrestling teams, they attribute it to Title IX as opposed to athletic directors' conscious and open choice to choose one sport over the other. And it really troubles me that they will say it's because of Title IX and women's sports.
Yeah, and we certainly heard that from some women who were in high school and college in 1972 when this law was initially passed. I heard stories from women in the course of my exploration of this title in the last couple of months that they heard, you know, boys' tennis was canceled or boys' wrestling was canceled due to Title IX. And I did learn that in some cases, the college or the high school, the institution, the educational institution was sort of testing the law in maybe a rebuttal to say if we cancel these popular things, the community will rise to fight for them. And in fact, the court held up the law to say, you know, it has to be equal or equitable. And so you decide if you have men or boys tennis or wrestling, you decide how you want to allocate the dollars. Is just make sure that you are spending equitable dollars and you pick the sports. And I think that's, to Donna, your point on the athletic directors making those decisions. It's not Title IX.
What would you hope, each of you, what would you hope people who are at this event in late October here in Milwaukee, what do you hope that they walk out the door with?
I guess speaking from the Women's Fund's perspective, we hope that the attendees have a better understanding of Title IX, the value of Title IX, but then also what Title IX and all the things that it has accomplished can do going forward. You know, what is the value in applying these concepts to the adult life in all aspects? How do we create equity using the accessibility to higher education, STEM careers, and the other aspects of Title IX to our advancement over the course of the coming weeks and years?
And Donna Orender?
Yeah, I all of that, and I hope to add a personal point of view and experience that gives all of us the understanding of how vital these opportunities are, the life-changing differences that they bring in the lives of girls, the impact in terms of our working lives, working side by side in terms with men and women and little girls and little boys, just how important from a very it's in the everyday living of our lives that mm-hmm. Title IX impacts us. And I hope to be able to share some stories that brings that to life in a way that inspires people, in a way that gets people up and say, hey, listen, I'm inspired to do my part. I see it now a little differently. And you know what? I want to help change the world.
Well, listen, Donna Orender, it was a real delight to have a chance to chat with you and have you share your story. And Lisa Adonito, thank you so much as well. Best of luck with the event.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Lisa. I look forward to being with everyone at the Women's Fund, and be well, everyone.
Donna Orender was a college and pro basketball player and the commissioner of the WNBA from 2005 to 2010. She'll give the keynote talk at an event marking 45 years of Title IX later this month.
Lisa Adonito is the executive director of the Women's Fund of Greater Milwaukee, organizer of the October 25th event. You can find more from a link at WUWM.com.
We'll take one last break, and then contributor Dave Beagle offers his impressions of the fall theater season already in progress. You are listening to Lake Effect from WUWM. Mm-hmm. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. As you have heard over the past several weeks, the fall theater season is well underway across town. We featured some of the most significant shows on stages around Milwaukee, but there are many others we just haven't had the chance to mention.
Contributor Dave Beagle has had a chance to take in what theaters have had to offer thus far this fall, and he is with us this morning. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Bonnie, Megan North.
How are you?
Since last we talked, you've had a birthday. Happy birthday.
Well, thank you so much. And you have seen a gazillion plays, I think.
I've seen a gazillion plays. There are eight plays that I've seen.
The last time we talked, we were mostly talking about what was happening out at APT.
Right.
And did they wrap up their season beautifully?
They wrapped yeah. another successful season. Were you able to get out there and see
that? I was not this year.
I'm saying you got to go next year. That new space out there is just, it's spectacular.
Did you see anything that wasn't worth your time out there this year? So it was all good?
Everything's good.
Cool.
Everything. I mean, they're uniformly exciting, interesting, daring, brave. Everything that a theater company ought to be, they are.
All right. Next year, I promise.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about it. But in the meantime, here in town, I think everything in the world has opened.
Pretty much everything is open. Renaissance hasn't opened yet. Sex with Strangers is coming up. We'll talk about that next time. Other than that, pretty much every theater's, got stuff on the boards. Led by, of course, the Rep. They got three shows running now, Guys and Dolls, the annual Mark Clements big musical that always opens the season. Last year it was La Mancha. This year it's Guys and Dolls. They've got the Iyad Akhtar play, The Who and the What, in the Stemke. And they've got this play, Souvenir, the story of Florence Foster Jenkins, in the Stackner, which is it's a tough evening. I love Jack Forbes Wilson. You know Jack.
Yes.
Jack is a local treasure, and when he's on stage, he's great. But that show to me was a one-trick pony. It's one joke. The joke is she can't sing, and he's not sure what to do about it. And they tell that same joke over and over and over and over. And by the time 90 minutes has passed, you want to hear another joke. You want to hear another joke. Having said that, the performance, the two people who did it, Margaret Wilbanks, who's this operatic singer from New York, and Jack, they were terrific. They were terrific. But it's a story that's missing.
Right. I think it's probably the show itself, maybe. Yeah. And one of the things that is so hard about a part like that is that you have to be really, really good to sing really, really badly.
Oh, my God. Oh.
To do it on purpose.
Yeah, right. Well, I was talking with Jack about it, and there are times when she's, singing off key, and she couldn't help herself. All of a sudden, she was on, right where she was supposed to be. And you just, if you can sing, which she obviously can, tough to sing badly.
Yeah.
It's easy for me, but tough for her.
And it may be me, too. We won't sing. We promise we won't sing.
The Iyad Akhtar play is an interesting play. He's from the Milwaukee area, grew up around here, Pulitzer Prize winner, great playwright. But the play itself, The Who and the What, it's about a Pakistani family, father, two daughters, the mother's dead, and a guy who's the suitor for one of the daughters. And the only difficulty I had with the play was that it was like watching a tennis match, volleys back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, two people. Very rarely did you hear three people on stage talking at one time, having conversations. I thought the point of the show was interesting about, how do you come to terms with your faith and the demands of the modern day. But I thought the structure was not great. I'm really looking forward to his new play, Junk.
Which just opened,
yeah,
right?
Lincoln Center, I think.
Yeah.
So it might be headed this way pretty soon. Let's hope.
That would be great.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. And so what did you think of Guys and Dolls?
Mark Clements can do a big musical unlike most people can do a big musical. I mean, that is his, it's in his ballpark. He can swing and hit it out of the park every time. This Guys and Dolls was great. I mean, a great dance. The choreography was spectacular. Taking a bunch of guys, the guys who weren't dancers and turned them into real dancers. It was wonderful. I thought that the four lead characters were uneven. Not that any of them were bad or not that any of them were great, but they were uneven. And you need four characters there that are pretty equal. You know, they've all got to be on the same level pretty much. And I didn't get that feeling in the show. But, you know, having said that, you know, the rep knows how to do a big musical, and they did a big musical, and I'm sure the crowds absolutely love it, you know. And those are all three of those shows are still up, and they'll still be up, you know, after the show. They run till either the end of October and a couple of them till early November.
Well, what about some of the other theaters in town? Because, like we said, everything seemed to have opened.
How about The Funniest Man in America?
Doug Jarecki. Yeah.
The funniest man in all of America.
I interviewed them for this show, and basically we all couldn't stop laughing. I had to edit out so much.
I'm telling you.
He was just hilarious.
This guy is, in December, he's got his show, 'Twas the Month Before Christmas, which is going to run at Next Act. It's one of the funniest shows I've ever seen. This show is part of that. Reforming Shakespeare?
A Reduced Shakespeare.
Reduced Shakespeare, yep. You know, where they take these books. You know, they did the complete works of Shakespeare abridged, and now they've got the great books abridged. It's very funny. I mean, like a lot of stuff like that, some of it kind of falls flat. I mean, when you're telling that many jokes in 2 hours, hard to tell every joke great. But a lot of them are very, very funny. And he is worth the price of admission, along with this kid, Chris Good, who I think I'd seen a couple times in Milwaukee. He plays the student teacher. It's a breathtaking kind of performance for a kid. I mean, he's got this kind of hangdog expression about him. You want to step up on the stage and give him a hug and pat him on the head and say, "Don't worry, everything's going to be okay, kid. Everything's going to be okay." But that's a show definitely to see, you know, in tandem, they're not above going lowbrow. They're not afraid to get down the gutter and say, "Let's laugh a little bit." And boy, they do it here.
And they do it really well.
Yeah, Chris Lear does a great job directing this show.
Okay.
I got to say something about Frankie and Johnny at the Clair de Lune at Chamber. Todd Denning and Marcy Kearns are as spectacular a couple of actors in one play as I've seen in Milwaukee in a long, long, long time. I mean, it's an interesting, interesting play. It's about ordinary people, and they both recognize how ordinary they are. They're not great looking. They're not really smart. They're not really rich. They don't have great jobs. There's no glamour to their lives. And in each other, they find this kind of sense of glamour. And It is such a powerful story for those of us who kind of walk on the quiet side of life. You know, not everybody leads a real exciting life. But, you know, there are a lot of people who lead lives, people used to say lives of quiet desperation. I'm not so sure it's quiet desperation, but it's quiet. And these two people have quiet lives, and they get together and they make some noise for each other. And she's long been one of my favorites. And she strips down. She goes naked in this thing. I mean, there are people there who are shocked, you know, who said, "Wow," you know, because, you know, she's a woman of a certain size and a certain build, you know. And she was as bold and as brave and as interesting a person as you could imagine. And Todd Denning matched her step for step. I mean, step for step.
And that's such an interesting play, too. It's a Terrence McNally piece, and it's been around for quite a while. And, you know, it kind of, I think you talked about it in your review, where there's a little bit of kind of like, if you didn't play it right, you could feel like stalking on his part.
Honest to God.
Because he won't leave her alone.
No.
The character won't leave her alone. Yeah.
Right. He pesters her. And if you did it wrong, you're absolutely right. It would be like a creepy guy. You know, like, ew, is he, you know, you repel at this guy. But he's so honest. Todd's a very honest actor, and the two of them together are just, God, they're fantastic.
So we have only till through this weekend
through
for that
this
one?
This weekend, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
We have that. We have Silent Sky at Next Act. This is Lauren Gunderson, who is, I think, the most produced living American playwright. She's just really something. Last year, Next Act staged The Taming, which was hers, and it was a powerful.
It was a great piece.
I mean, it was a great piece. I mean, it was three great actors. It was everything about it. Well, this is a very interesting play, much different. It's a very quiet play. Deborah Staples plays Henrietta Leavitt, who was around the turn of a century. She wanted to be an astronomer. And she got a job at Harvard, and she was doing women's work and all the rest of the stuff. And she made the discoveries that allowed us to map the size of the universe, how big it is. You know, it's a quiet, quiet show, but it's a killer cast. Kelly Doherty, for God's sakes, Kerry Hitchcock, Rana Roman, and Reese Madigan, five people, and along with Deborah Staples. You can hardly go wrong. It's a powerful, you know, David Cesarini loves to do shows that have kind of political overtones and importance, and he's got one here, and his wife, Deborah, is just
terrific.
Spectacular.
Yeah.
One other show I got to mention, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, opened at First Stage. First Stage will never cease to amaze me. I mean, what they do with kids and actors, and they've got two of the lions of Wisconsin theater in this, Drew Brell and Robert Spencer. It is worth the price of admission just to go watch these two people work. First Stage is a great family theater. They've long passed the children's theater phase, and they truly are now a family theater, and it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful experience. It's a show that is so much fun. You walk out of there and you go, God, I'm kind of glad I'm alive. That's what it's like.
Hey, and you know, and if theater can make you feel that way, that's a fantastic thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's what it ought to do.
Exactly. Something needs to make us feel that
way. Yeah, right, right.
I think basically you're saying, though, don't take a pass on any of these shows that are going on in town.
You know, I'm telling you, and it's rare, I think, at the start of the season where every play I see seems to be a good play.
We forgot one.
Yeah?
Hot Mikado.
Oh, my God. We did forget Hot, and how
we
could I
forget? We cannot forget Hot Mikado.
Cannot forget Hot Mikado. This is, I'm not even sure how you'd describe it. Did you see Milwaukee Opera Theater's Mikado?
Yes.
Well, I've now seen two Mikados in 6 months, and I said to myself, is that too many? It's not. This one stands right besides that Milwaukee Opera Theater one as far as funny goes, good music. Outstanding choreography. The Rage of Off era is off and running at Skylight. And, he hit a home run for the first show that he programmed. I mean, an absolute home run. It is funny. It's clear. You know, some of that Gilbert and Sullivan stuff, sometimes you go, now, wait a minute, what are they doing here? This one is clear as a bell. You know exactly what's going on.
All right, so I just have way too many things to go see, so I think we need to wrap up so I can go get some tickets.
I'm going to see you on the aisle, Bonnie.
You will.
I'm going to see you on the aisle.
Thanks, Dave.
Okay.
Dave Beagle is a longtime Milwaukee theater critic. He joins us every so often to share his thoughts on shows and trends on the stages around the region. You can find links to his reviews at WUWM.com. And that is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock.